Chapter 5. The Hostile Brothers. Archetypes of Response to the Unknown. The contamination of anomaly with the threat of death, attendant on the development of self-consciousness, amplifies the valence of the unknown to a virtually unbearable point. This unbearable amplification has motivated the development of two transpersonal patterns of behavior and schemas of representation, constituting the individual as such, embodied in mythology as the Hostile Brothers. One of these Hostile Brothers, or Eternal Sons of God, is the mythological hero. He faces the unknown with the presumption of its benevolence, with the unprovable attitude that confrontation with the unknown will bring renewal and redemption. He enters voluntarily into creative union with the Great Mother, builds or regenerates society, and brings peace to a warring world. The other Son of God is the eternal adversary. This spirit of unbridled rationality, horrified by his limited apprehension of the conditions of existence, shrinks from contact with everything he does not understand. This shrinking weakens his personality, no longer nourished by the water of life, and makes him rigid and authoritarian as he clings desperately to the familiar, rational, and stable. Every deceitful retreat increases his fear. Every new protective law increases his frustration, boredom, and contempt for life. His weakness, in combination with his neurotic suffering, engenders resentment and hatred for existence itself. The personality of this adversary comes in two forms, so to speak, although these two forms are inseparably linked. The fascist sacrifices his soul, which would enable him to confront change on his own, to the group, which promises to protect him from everything unknown. The decadent, by contrast, refuses to join the social world and clings rigidly to his own ideas, merely because he is too undisciplined to serve as an apprentice. The fascist wants to crush everything different, and then everything. The decadent immolates himself and builds the fascist from his ashes. The bloody excesses of the 20th century manifest most evidently in the culture of the concentration camp, stand as testimony to the desires of the adversary and as monument to his power. The pitfalls of fascism and decadence may be avoided through identification with the hero, the true individual. The hero organizes the demands of social being and the responsibilities of his own soul into a coherent, hierarchically arranged unit. He stands on the border between order and chaos and serves the group as creator and agent of renewal. The hero's voluntary contact with the unknown transforms it into something benevolent, into the eternal source, in fact, of strength and ability. Development of such strength, attendant upon faith in the conditions of experience, enables him to stand outside the group when necessary and to use it as a tool rather than as armor. The hero rejects identification with the group as the ideal of life, preferring to follow the dictates of his conscience and his heart. His identification with meaning and his refusal to sacrifice meaning for security renders existence acceptable, despite its tragedy. Introduction: The Hero and the Adversary. The culture bequeathed to us by our forebears degenerates of its own accord, as the flux of the present invalidates the static presuppositions of the past. We may speed this process of degeneration by our sins, by voluntary refusal to attend to our errors when they manifest themselves, and by failure to adjust behaviors and attitudes in consequence. Through such refusal and failure, we transform the irritations of the present into the catastrophes of the future and invite a wrathful God to drown us beneath the waves. Mircea Eliade summarizes, As has been well known since the compilations made by R. Andre, H. Usener, and J. G. Fraser, the deluge myth is almost universally disseminated. It is documented in all the continents, although very rarely in Africa, and on various cultural levels. A certain number of variants seem to be the result of dissemination, first from Mesopotamia and then from India. It is equally possible that one or several diluvial catastrophes gave rise to fabulous narratives. But it would be risky to explain so widespread a myth by phenomena of which no geological traces have been found. The majority of the flood myths seem, in some sense, to form part of the cosmic rhythm. The old world, peopled by a fallen humanity, is submerged under the waters, and sometime later a new world emerges from the aquatic chaos. In a large number of variants, the flood is the result of the sins or ritual faults of human beings. Sometimes it results simply from the wish of a divine being to put an end to mankind. The chief causes lie at once in the sins of men and the decrepitude of the world. By the mere fact that it exists, that is, that it lives and produces, the cosmos gradually deteriorates and ends by falling into decay. This is the reason why it has to be recreated. In other words, the flood realizes, on the macrocosmic scale, what is symbolically affected during the New Year festival, the end of the world, and the end of a sinful humanity, in order to make a new creation possible. No discussion of the architecture of belief can possibly be considered complete in the absence of reference to evil. Evil is no longer a popular word, so to speak. The term is generally considered old-fashioned, not applicable in a society that has theoretically dispensed with its religious preoccupations. Acts once defined as evil are now merely considered the consequence of unjust familial, social, or economic structures, although this view is not as widespread as it once was. Alternatively, the commission of incomprehensible acts of cruelty and destruction are viewed as symptomatic of some physiological weakness or disease. Seldom are acts of evil considered voluntary or purposeful, committed by someone possessed by an aesthetic that makes an art of terror and pain. In the Egyptian cosmology, Osiris, the king, mythic image of the known, the great father, has an eternal evil twin and opposite, Seth, who eventually leads Osiris to his death. 4,000 years later, the moral of this great story has not yet been grasped. Failure to understand the nature of evil leads to its eventual victory. At the end of this, the most cruel and bloodthirsty of centuries, we are in danger not only of failing to understand evil, but of denying its very existence. Invisibility, however, is what the devil craves most. I have spent a substantial amount of time up to this point describing the nature of culture and the manner in which it is generated. Culture, the great father, protects us from the terrors of the unknown, defines around us a sacred space into which nothing unbearably foreign is allowed. Culture is generated by the process whose essential features have been captured in the pervasive and recurrent myths of the hero. This hero is the individual who voluntarily faces the dragon of the unknown, cuts it up, and creates the world from its pieces. The individual who overcomes the too long senescent tyrant and frees the virgin mother from his grasp. Such myths present a world starkly ambivalent in its nature. The natural world is endlessly creative and equally destructive. The inextricably associated social environment is simultaneously tyrannical and protective. So far in our discussion, however, the hero has stood alone. This means that our story is far from over. The essential ambivalence characterizing the constituent elements of experience extends to the individual as well, who is capable of thoughts and actions as dark and destructive as anything in society or nature. Mythology envelops the transpersonal capacity for evil characterizing the individual as such in the guise of a personality, duplicating its encapsulation of chaos and order. The dark side of the individual is the absolute adversary of the hero, the personality who shrinks from contact with the unknown or who denies that it exists instead of actively approaching and exploring, the personality whose advice speeds the decline of society rather than its renewal. The image of this personality, like the phenomenon itself, has developed and become elaborated in complexity and sophistication over the course of centuries. Proper understanding of its nature is terrifying in a salutary sort of way. This informative terror is the purpose of encapsulation in narrative, in transpersonal memory. The image of the Christian devil, for example, is the best bad example available. His implicit or explicit imitation leads to disaster. The stories that portray his central features exist as object lessons in the consequences of resentment, hatred, totalitarian arrogance, and jealousy. Evil, like good, is not something static. It does not merely mean breaking the rules, for example, and is not simply aggression, anger, force, pain, disappointment, anxiety, or horror. Life is, of course, endlessly complicated by the fact that what is bad in one circumstance is positively necessary in the next. I noted previously that the answer to the question, what is the good, must in fact be sought in the meta-domain, so to speak. The more fundamental mystery, given the context-dependent nature of the good, is how our answers to the question, what is the good, endlessly and appropriately generated. The good, then, becomes the set of circumstances that allow the process of moral construction to flourish, or becomes the process of moral construction itself. The problem, what then is evil, must be addressed similarly. Evil is rejection of and sworn opposition to the process of creative exploration. Evil is proud repudiation of the unknown and willful failure to understand, transcend, and transform the social world. Evil is, in addition, and in consequence, hatred of the virtuous and courageous, precisely on account of their virtue and courage. Evil is the desire to disseminate darkness for the love of darkness, where there could be light. The spirit of evil underlies all actions that speed along the decrepitude of the world, that foster God's desire to inundate and destroy everything that exists. Great evils are easily identifiable, at least in retrospect, and are usually the result, at least in interpretation, of the act of another. We build endless memorials to the Holocaust, for example, and swear never to forget. But what is it that we are remembering? What is the lesson we are supposed to have learned? We don't know how the Holocaust came about, don't know what it is that the people involved did or failed to do step by step that made them behave in such an appalling manner, don't know what or who made German society take such a terrible turn. How could Hitler fail to believe that he was correct when everyone around him bowed to his orders? Would it not take character of exceptional magnitude to resist the temptation of absolute power freely offered, democratically granted, even insisted upon? How would it be possible for anyone to remain properly humble under such conditions? Most of us have personal frailties that remain constrained by our social environments. Our neurotic tendencies are checked by the people around us who care for us, who complain and protest when we lose our self-control and take things in our weakness one step too far. If everyone around thinks you are the savior, who is left to point out your defects and keep you conscious of them? This is not an apology for Hitler, merely recognition that he was all too human. And what does that statement mean? Hitler was human, Stalin too, Idi Amin too. What does that say about being human? Our tyrannical tendencies and moral decadences generally find their expression limited by our narrow domains of personal power. We cannot doom millions to death at a whim because we do not have the resources to do so. We satisfy ourselves in the absence of such power with riding roughshod over those near to us and congratulate ourselves on our moral virtue. We use aggression and strength to bend dependent others to our will, or, in the absence of strength, use sickness and weakness to harness the force of empathy and deceive our way to dominance underground. Granted the opportunity, how many of us would not be Hitlers, assuming we had the ambition, dedication, and power of organization, which is highly unlikely? Paucity of skill, however, does not constitute moral virtue. Many kings are tyrants or moral decadents because they are people, and many people are tyrants or moral decadents. We cannot say never again as a consequence of the memory of the Holocaust because we do not understand the Holocaust, and it is impossible to remember what has not been understood. We do not understand the Holocaust because we do not comprehend ourselves. Human beings, very much like ourselves, produced the moral catastrophes of the Second World War and of Stalin's Soviet Union and of Pol Pot's Cambodia. Never forget means know thyself. Recognize and understand that evil twin, that mortal enemy who is part and parcel of every individual. The heroic tendency, the archetypal savior, is an eternal spirit, which is to say, a central and permanent aspect of human being. The same is true precisely of the adversarial tendency, the capacity for endless denial and the desire to make everything suffer for the outrage of its existence is an ineradicable intrapsychic element of the individual. The great dramatists and religious thinkers of the world have been able to grasp this fact, at least implicitly, and to transmit it in story and image. Modern analytic thinkers and existential theorists have attempted to abstract these ideas upward into higher consciousness and to present them in logical and purely semantic form. Sufficient material has been gathered to present a compelling portrait of evil. The adversary, emergence, development, and representation. The figure of Satan is arguably the most well-developed representation of evil extant in religious and mythological thought. Although it is tempting to identify this personage with particular personality attributes, such as aggression, or with the differences of the stranger, it is more realistic to view him as the embodiment of a personal and social process. The devil is the spirit who underlies the development of totalitarianism, the spirit who is characterized by rigid ideological belief, by the predominance of the rational mind, by reliance on the lie as a mode of adaptation, by refusal to admit to the existence of error or to appreciate the necessity of deviance, and by the inevitable development of hatred for the self and world. Each of these characteristics is intrinsically and causally related to the others. They are linked inextricably together and can be aptly conceptualized as a transpersonal and eternal personality. The devil is willful rejection of the process that makes life bearable, out of spite for the tragic conditions of existence. This rejection is intellectually arrogant because the conditions are interpreted. Which is to say, development of self-consciousness tainted everything with death, but self-consciousness is contained within a global understanding that is still exceptionally limited in its scope. The present, as currently interpreted, is indeed the unbearable present, but that interpretation may change if the possibility for change is not disallowed as a consequence of absolutist belief, conceit, and resentment. The devil works to eliminate the world as something whose weakness and vulnerability makes it contemptible. He has produced dreadful suffering in the 20th century, not least among cultures who have dispensed with his image. We are fortunate to have survived without an irreversible tragedy. Our luck to date should not blind us to the dangers of continued ignorance or to the necessity of bringing our poorly comprehended selves under control. Every technological advance we make increases our power. Every increase in power makes our internal integration and expanded self-consciousness that much more necessary. Friedrich Nietzsche states, "The noble soul has reverence for itself." As I look deep into the problem of evil over the 14 years associated with writing this book, I found myself increasingly and involuntarily fascinated with the myth of Satan and curious about the position of this story in Western thought. The idea of the devil has exerted a powerful influence on the development of Christianity and Christian culture, and therefore on Western and world society, although there is little direct reference to Satan in the Old and New Testaments. Surprisingly little. No description of hell to speak of, limited and oblique reference to the rebellion of the angels and the war in heaven preceding the establishment of hell, nothing of any consequence regarding the terrible afterlife that theoretically awaits all sinners. It is my understanding that traditional and literary representations of Satan, the ruling angel of hell, constitute true mythology. These ideas surround the established central writings and ideas of Christianity like fog surrounds a mountain. They have been transmitted to us in part as religious doctrine, in part as oral tradition, in part because of the efforts of Dante and Milton. I had a very limited religious education in my youth, and all I ever knew about the devil was hearsay, bits and pieces I picked up while reading other material, such as Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which contains a terrifying Jesuit sermon on the wages of sin. All I knew was the outline of the story codified by Milton. Satan, the highest angel in God's heavenly hierarchy, desired to become like the Most High and fostered a rebellion in heaven. He was defeated and cast unrepentant into hell, where he rules eternally over the spirits of the sinful dead. I had no real idea what this story meant, although it was obvious to me that these characters and events could have never really existed. I learned later that the association made between the serpent in Eden and the devil was essentially speculative. Indeed, certain Gnostics had even posited that the deity who brought Adam and Eve to the light of self-consciousness was a higher spirit than the unconscious demiurge who had created everything in the beginning. This idea was predicated upon Gnostic recognition that a fall from paradise, from a previous plane of stability, often comprised the necessary precondition for movement to a higher place. Traditional medieval Christians developed a similar idea. For them, original sin was a fortunate error that made necessary the incarnation of Christ. This meant that the Christian fall, although tragic in and of itself, could be regarded as positively beneficial, since it brought about the redemptive incarnation of God, which was the most stupendous event in history from the Christian perspective. Adoption of this broader viewpoint allowed even the Edenic serpent, who propelled mankind into chaos, to be interpreted as a tool of God. As a tool of the beneficial God who is endlessly working to bring about the perfection of the world despite the troublesome existence of free choice and demonic temptation. The name Lucifer means bringer of light, after all. I also knew, more or less unconsciously, that the devil has been long associated with the power and arrogance of rational thought, in Goethe's Faust, for example. This association has enabled the dogmatic forces of the Church to adopt an anti-scientific stance frequently, science equals rationality equals devil, and to justify unfortunate Church opposition to emergent truth. However, a mythological idea, is not invalidated as an idea in consequence of its misapplication. The capacity for rational thought is a dangerous force, without doubt, because it is a powerful force, and the conditions under which thinking plays a purely destructive role are still not well comprehended. This plethora of vaguely related ideas and stories kept entering and re-entering my mind, most frequently in combination with remembrance of a telling symbolic historic act, the transformation of the Notre Dame Cathedral into the Temple of Reason in the midst of the terrors of the French Revolution. It is no easy matter to come to a clear understanding of such notions, to grasp their nature logically or emotionally, or even to determine how they could possibly be related. After all, we tend to regard the development of clear understanding as equivalent to the construction of a proper set, and assume that the reality of a thing can be clearly defined. Ideas about evil, however, do not form a proper set. They form a natural category containing diverse material, just like ideas about the known or the unknown. To complicate things further, evil, like good, is not something static, although it may align itself with all that is stubbornly static. It is rather a dynamic process, a spirit that partakes of the motivational or affective states of pride, resentment, jealousy, and hatred, but cannot be identified unerringly with the presence of any or all. The morality of an aggressive act, for example, depends on the nature of the context in which it is manifested, just as the meaning of a given word is defined by the sentence, the paragraph, even the book or culture in which it appears. Evil is a living complex. Its nature can be most clearly comprehended through examination of the personality it has adopted in mythology, literature, and fantasy, elaborated in the lengthy course of historical development. This personality consists of those meta-attributes of evil that have remained stable over time despite dramatic shifts in the particulars of human existence and human morality. The image of the devil is the form that the idea of evil has taken, for better or worse, at least in the West. We have not yet developed an explicit model of evil that would allow us to forget, transcend, or otherwise dispense with this mythological representation. We rationalize our lack of such understanding by presuming that the very notion of evil is archaic. This is a truly ridiculous presumption in this century of indescribable horror. In our ignorance and complacency, we deride ancient stories about the nature of evil, equating them half-consciously with childish things best put away. This is an exceedingly arrogant position. There is no evidence whatsoever that we understand the nature of evil any better than our forebears, despite our psychology, even though our expanded technological power has made us much more dangerous when we are possessed. Our ancestors were at least constantly concerned with the problem of evil. Acceptance of the harsh Christian dogma of original sin, for example, despite its pessimism and apparent inequity, at least meant recognition of evil. Such dogma at least promoted some consideration of the tendency toward evil as an intrinsic, heritable aspect of human nature. From the perspective informed by belief in original sin, individual actions and motivations must always be carefully scrutinized and considered, even when apparently benevolent, lest the ever-present adversarial tendencies accidentally gain the upper hand. The dogma of original sin forces every individual to regard himself as the potential immediate source of evil, and to locate the terrible underworld of mythology and its denizens in intrapsychic space. It is no wonder that this idea has become unpopular. Nonetheless, evil exists somewhere. it remains difficult not to see hypocrisy in the souls of those who wish to localize it somewhere else. Once I understood these things in a provisional sort of way, the ancient ideas began to sort themselves out. I learned from Eliade how to make sense out of the notion of a heavenly hierarchy. The monotheism of Judaism and Christianity has its roots in older, more polytheistic thinking. The many gods of archaic conceptualization became the single ruler of more modern religious thinking as a consequence of spiritual competition, so to speak. This competition is the battle of ideas with implication for action, fought in abstraction, image, and in the course of genuine earthly combat, portrayed in mythology as spiritual war played out in heaven, which is the place where transpersonal ideas exist. The deity who came to prevail over all is one God, with a complex set of attributes, surrounded by a panoply of angels and divine echoes of previous gods, who represent those transpersonal and eternal psychological processes rendered subordinate in the course of the spiritual phylogenesis of man. Christian mythology portrays Satan as the highest angel in God's heavenly kingdom. This fact renders his association with reason more comprehensible. Reason may well be considered the highest angel, which is to say, the most developed and remarkable psychological or spiritual faculty characteristic of all men, and therefore something transpersonal and eternal. Figure 57, the devil as aerial spirit and ungodly intellect, portrays Eugene Delacroix's imagistic interpretation, an illustration for part one of Faust. Reason, the most exceptional of spirits, suffers from the greatest of temptations. Reason's own capacity for self-recognition and self-admiration means endless capacity for pride, which is the act of presuming omniscience. It is reason's remarkable ability and its own recognition of that ability that leads it to believe it possesses absolute knowledge and can therefore replace or do without God. He trusted to have equaled the Most High if he opposed, and with ambitious aim against the throne and monarchy of God raised impious war in heaven. Milton from Paradise Lost. It is reason's belief in its own omniscience, manifest in procedure and image, if not in word, that unconsciously underlies totalitarianism in its many destructive guises. Northrop Frye notes, "A demonic fall, as Milton presents it, involves defiance of and rivalry with God rather than simple disobedience, and hence the demonic society is a sustained and systematic parody of the divine one, associated with devils or fallen angels because it seems far beyond normal human capacities in its powers. We read of ascending and descending angels on Jacob's and Plato's ladders, and similarly there seem to be demonic reinforcements in heathen life that account for the almost superhuman grandeur of the heathen empires, especially just before they fall." Two particularly notable passages in the Old Testament prophets linked to this theme are the denunciation of Babylon in Isaiah 14 and of Tyre in Ezekiel 28. Babylon is associated with Lucifer, the morning star, who said to himself, "I will be like the Most High." Tyre is identified with a covering cherub, a splendid creature living in the Garden of Eden till the day that iniquity was found in thee. In the New Testament, Luke 10:18, Jesus speaks of Satan as falling from heaven. Hence Satan's traditional identification with Isaiah's Lucifer and his growth in legend into the great adversary of God, once the prince of the angels, and before being displaced, the firstborn son of God. The superhuman demonic force behind the heathen kingdoms is called in Christianity the Antichrist, the earthly ruler demanding divine honors. It is not that easy to understand why the act of presuming omniscience is reasonably construed as precisely opposite to the act of creative exploration, as the adversary is opposite to the hero. What knowing everything means, however, at least in practice, is that the unknown no longer exists, and that further exploration has therefore been rendered superfluous, even treacherous. This means that absolute identification with the known necessarily comes to replace all opportunity for identification with the process that comes to know. The presumption of absolute knowledge, which is the cardinal sin of the rational spirit, is therefore prima facie equivalent to rejection of the hero, to rejection of Christ, of the Word of God, of the divine process that mediates between order and chaos. The arrogance of the totalitarian stance is ineradicably opposed to the humility of creative exploration. Humility. It is only constant admission of error and capacity for error, admission of sinful and ignorant nature, that allows for recognition of the unknown and then for update of knowledge and adaptation in behavior. Such humility is, somewhat paradoxically, courageous, as admission of error and possibility for error constitutes the necessary precondition for confrontation with the unknown. This makes genuine cowardice the underground motivation for the totalitarian presumption. The true authoritarian wants everything unpredictable to vanish. The authoritarian protects himself from knowledge of this cowardice by a show of patriotic advocacy, often at apparent cost to himself. In the fifth book of Paradise Lost, which Milton constructed from biblical and mythological allusions, Lucifer is passed over by God in honor of the second son, Christ. This shift in the dominance hierarchy of heaven seems to me to indicate that reason, which in consequence of its self-recognition as the highest angel of God believes itself capable of single-handedly engendering redemption, must remain subordinate to the processes of the exploratory hero. Reason can serve health only when it plays a secondary role. The option of ruling in hell rather than serving in heaven nonetheless appears as an attractive alternative to the rational mind under a wide variety of circumstances. The devil is the spirit who eternally states, "All that I know is all that there is to be known." The spirit who falls in love with his own beautiful productions and, in consequence, can no longer see beyond them. The devil is the desire to be right above all, to be right once and for all and finally, rather than to constantly admit to insufficiency and ignorance and to therefore partake in the process of creation itself. The devil is the spirit which endlessly denies because it is afraid in the final analysis, afraid and weak. It is lack of discrimination between the existence of the adversary as process with the existence of anomaly as constituent element of experience that has led to some of the worst excesses of Christianity, and not just Christianity. It has constantly been the case that proper thinking people confuse the existence of threats to their security and moral integrity with evil. This means that the proper thinking confuse the being of the genius and the stranger who offer up experience that exists in contrast with established belief with the process of rejection of such experience. This lack of discrimination is both comprehensible and motivated. Comprehensible, because the strange, stranger, strange idea, revolutionary hero upsets the apple cart and produces affective dysregulation, which is the state most devoutly desired by the devil. Motivated, because categorizing anomaly with evil allows for its justified repression. The heroic act of updating current morality, however, through the promotion of uncomfortable contact with the unknown, creates chaos only in the service of higher order. To repress that process and cling patriotically to tradition is to ensure that tradition will collapse precipitously and far more dangerously at some point in the not-too-distant future. The fact of my lascivious or aggressive fantasy, to take a specific example of things generally regarded in a dim light, is not evil if I am a devout Christian. Evil is the act of denying that such fantasy exists, or perhaps the act of realizing that fantasy without consideration of its proper place. The fantasy itself merely constitutes information, unacceptable information to be sure, from the current merely provisional standpoint, but information with the capacity to transform if admitted. The existence of the Muslim and the Muslim viewpoint likewise is not evil if I am a devout Christian. Evil is instead my presumption of personal omniscience, my certainty that I understand my Christian belief well enough to presume its necessary opposition to the stranger and his ideas, my certainty that identification with a static, comprehended moral structure is sufficient to guarantee my integrity, and my consequent ignorant and self-righteous persecution of the Muslim. The devil is not the uncomfortable fact, but the act of shrinking from that fact. The weaknesses, stupidities, laxities, and ignorances that ineradicably constitute the individual are not evil in and of themselves. These insufficiencies are a necessary consequence of the limitations that make experience possible. It is the act of denying that stupidity exists once it has manifested itself that is evil, because stupidity cannot then be overcome. Such denial brings spiritual progress to a halt. Consciousness of ignorance and cupidity manifests itself in shame, anxiety, and pain, in the guise of the visitor whose arrival is most feared, and such consciousness may consequently come to be considered the embodiment of evil itself. But it is the bearer of bad news who brings us closer to the light if the significance of the news is allowed to manifest itself. The religious scholar Elaine Pagels has written a book, The Origin of Satan, in which she describes how the idea of the devil as the eternal enemy of Christ enabled those who profess Christianity to persecute those who do not. The presuppositions of the persecutor are, for example, the devil is the enemy. The Jew is not a Christian. The Jew is an enemy. The Jew is the devil. Pagels presents the not unreasonable and justifiably popular hypothesis that the invention of Satan was motivated by desire to transform the act of persecuting others into a moral virtue. It appears, however, that the historical developmental path of the idea of the adversary is somewhat more complex. Transpersonal notions of the breadth of the image of the devil cannot emerge as a consequence of conscious motivation, because their development requires many centuries of transgenerational work, which cannot be easily organized. The image of the devil, although endlessly applied to rationalize the subjugation of others, as all great ideas can be subverted, emerged as a consequence of endless genuine attempts to encapsulate the personality of evil. The logic that associates the other with the devil works only for those who think that religion means belief, that is, identification with a set of static and often unreasonable facts, and not action, meta-imitation, or the incarnation of the creative process in behavior. The existence of the anomalous fact, properly considered, the uncomfortable fact embodied in the stranger or rendered abstract in the form of differing philosophy, is a call to religious action and not an evil. It has taken mankind thousands of years of work to develop dawning awareness of the nature of evil, to produce a detailed, dramatic representation of the process that makes up the core of human maladaptation and voluntarily produced misery. It seems premature to throw away the fruit of that labor or to presume that it is something other than what it appears before we understand what it signifies. Consciousness of evil emerged first as ritual enactment, then as dynamic image expressed in myth. This representation covers a broad spatial and temporal territory whose examination helps flesh out understanding of the personality of the adversary. The most thoroughly developed archaic personification of evil can perhaps be found in the ideas of Zoroastrianism, which flourished in relatively explicit form from 1000 to 600 BC, and which undoubtedly depended for its form on much more ancient, less explicit ideas. The Zoroastrians developed a number of ideas which were later incorporated into Christianity, including, according to Eliada, the myth of the Savior, the elaboration of an optimistic eschatology proclaiming the final triumph of good and universal salvation, and the doctrine of the resurrection of bodies. Zarathustra, the mythic founder of Zoroastrianism, was a follower of Ahura Mazda, the central deity in this essentially monotheistic religion. Ahura, sky, Mazda, was surrounded by a pantheon of divine entities, the Amesha Spentas, analogous to angels, who were very evidently psychological in their nature, at least from the modern perspective. These spirits included Asha, justice, Vohumana, good thought, Armaiti, devotion, Kshatra, power, Harvatat, integrity, and Ameritat, immortality. Ahura Mazda was also the father of twin brothers, spirits, Spentamenu, the beneficent spirit, and Angramenu, the destroying spirit. Iliada states, "In the beginning, it is stated in a famous Gatha, Yasna 30, authored by Zarathustra, these two spirits chose, one of them good in life, the other evil and death. Spentamenu declares, at the beginning of existence, to the destroying spirit, neither our thoughts nor our doctrines nor our mental powers, neither our choices nor our words nor our acts, neither our consciences nor our souls are in agreement. This shows that the two spirits, the one holy, the other wicked, differ rather by choice than by nature." Zarathustra's theology is not dualistic in the strict sense of the term, since Ahura Mazda is not confronted by an anti-god. In the beginning, the opposition breaks out between the two spirits. On the other hand, the unity between Ahura Mazda and the holy, good spirit is several times implied, see Yasna 43.3, etc. In short, good and evil, the Holy One and the destroying demon, proceed from Ahura Mazda, but since Angramenu freely chose his mode of being and his maleficent vocation, the wise Lord cannot be considered responsible for the appearance of evil. On the other hand, Ahura Mazda, in his omniscience, knew from the beginning what choice the destroying spirit would make, and nevertheless did not prevent it. This may mean either that God transcends all kinds of contradictions, or that the existence of evil constitutes the preliminary condition for human freedom. The mythic hostile brothers, Spentamenu and Angramenu, Osiris and Seth, Gilgamesh and Enkidu, Cain and Abel, Christ and Satan, are representative of two eternal individual tendencies, twin sons of God, heroic and adversarial. The former tendency, the archetypal savior, is the everlasting spirit of creation and transformation, characterized eternally by the capacity to admit to the unknown and therefore to progress toward the kingdom of heaven. The eternal adversary, by contrast, is incarnation in practice, imagination, and philosophy of the spirit of denial, eternal rejection of the redeeming unknown, and the adoption of rigid self-identification. Myths of the hostile brothers, like those of the Zoroastrians, tend to emphasize the role of free choice in determination of essential mode of being. Christ, for example, and Gautama Buddha are tempted constantly and potently toward evil, but choose to reject it. Angra Mainyu and Satan accept evil, by contrast, and revel in it, despite evidence that it produces their own suffering. The choice of these spirits cannot be reduced to some more essential aspect, such as the particular conditions of existence, which are identical anyway for both beings, or the vagaries of intrinsic nature. It is voluntary willingness to do what is known to be wrong, despite the capacity to understand and avoid such action that most particularly characterizes evil, the evil of spirit and man. So, Milton's God can comment in Paradise Lost on the degeneration of Satan and mankind. So will fall, he and his faithless progeny. Whose fault? Whose but his own? Ingrate. He had of me all he could have. I made him just and right, sufficient to have stood, though free to fall. Refusal of the good is, I think, most effectively and frequently justified by reference to the terrible affective consequences of self-consciousness. This means that comprehension of the vulnerability and mortality of man and the suffering associated with that vulnerability, apprehension of the ultimate cruelty and pointlessness of life, may be used as rationale for evil. Life is terrible, and appears at some moments ultimately terrible, unfair, irrational, painful, and meaningless. Interpreted in such a light, existence itself may well appear as something reasonably eradicated. Goethe's Mephistopheles, Prince of Lies, defines his philosophy in consequence in the following terms, in Part 1 of Faust. The spirit I that endlessly denies, and rightly too. For all that comes to birth is fit for overthrow as nothing worth, wherefore the world were better sterilized. Thus, all that's here as evil recognized is gain to me, and downfall, ruin, sin, the very element I prosper in. Mephistopheles repeats this credo in slightly elaborated form in Part 2. Gone to sheer nothing, past with null made one. What matters our creative endless toil when, at a snatch, oblivion ends the coil? It is bygone. How shall this riddle run? As good as if things never had begun, yet circle back. Existence to possess, I'd rather have eternal emptiness. Spiritual reality plays itself out endlessly in profane reality, as man remains eternally subject to the dictates of the gods. Individual persons therefore unconsciously embody mythological themes. Such embodiment becomes particularly evident in the case of great individuals, where the play of divine forces becomes virtually tangible. We analyzed sections of Leo Tolstoy's autobiography previously, using his self-reported personal experience as universal exemplar for the catastrophic primary affective consequences of revolutionary anomaly. Tolstoy's secondary ideological response to such anomaly is equally archetypal. The news from Western Europe, the revelation of the death of God, cascaded through the great author's implicit and explicit culturally determined beliefs and action schemas, propelling him headlong over a very lengthy period of time into emotional turmoil and existential chaos. Identification with the spirit of denial lurked as a profound temptation in the midst of that chaos. Tolstoy begins the relevant section of his confession with an allegory derived from A Tale of the East. A traveler, chased by a wild beast, jumps down an old well. He grabs the branch of a vine that happens to be growing there and clings to it. At the bottom of the well lurks an ancient dragon, mouth gaping. Above the well is the terrible beast, so there is no turning back. The traveler's arms grow weak, clinging to the vine, but he still holds on. Then he sees two mice, one black, one white, gnawing at either side of the very branch that supports him. Soon they will chew their way through and send him plummeting into the dragon's gullet. The traveler sees some drops of honey on the leaves of the vine. He stretches out his tongue, tastes the honey, and is comforted. For Tolstoy, however, the pleasures of life had lost their analgesic sweetness. I could not be deceived. All is vanity. Happy is he who has never been born. Death is better than life. We must rid ourselves of life. Having failed to find an explanation in knowledge, I began to look for it in life, hoping to find it in the people around me. And so I began to observe people like myself, to see how they lived, and to determine what sort of relation they had with the question that had led me to despair. And this is what I found among people whose circumstances were precisely the same as mine with respect to education and way of life. I found that for the people of my class, there were four means of escaping the terrible situation in which we all find ourselves. The first means of escape is that of ignorance. It consists of failing to realize and to understand that life is evil and meaningless. For the most part, people in this category are women, or they are very young or very stupid men. They have still not understood the problem of life that presented itself to Schopenhauer, Solomon, and the Buddha. They see neither the dragon that awaits them nor the mice gnawing away at the branch they cling to. They simply lick the drops of honey. But they lick these drops of honey only for the time being. Something will turn their attention toward the dragon and the mice, and there will be an end to their licking. There was nothing for me to learn from them, since we cannot cease to know what we know. The second escape is that of Epicureanism. Fully aware of the hopelessness of life, it consists of enjoying, for the present, the blessings that we do have without looking at the dragon or the mice. It lies in licking the honey as best we can, especially in those places where there is the most honey on the bush. Solomon describes this escape in the following manner. And I commended mirth, for there is nothing better for man under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. This will be his mainstay in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. So go and eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine in the gladness of your heart. Enjoy life with a woman you love through all the days of your life of vanity, through all your vain days. For this is your fate in life and in the labors by which you toil under the sun. Do whatever you can do by the strength of your hand, for there is no work in the grave where you are going, no reflection, no knowledge, no wisdom. Tolstoy continues, most people of our class pursue this second means of escape. The situation in which they find themselves is such that it affords them more of the good things in life than the bad. Their moral stupidity enables them to forget that all the advantages of their position are accidental, that not everyone can have 1,000 women and palaces as Solomon did. They forget that for every man with 1,000 wives, there are 1,000 men without wives, that for every palace, there are 1,000 men who built it by the sweat of their brows. And that the same chance that has made them a Solomon today might well make them Solomon's slave tomorrow. The dullness of the imagination of these people enables them to forget what left the Buddha with no peace. The inevitability of sickness, old age, and death, which if not today, then tomorrow, will destroy all these pleasures. The fact that some of these people maintain that their dullness of thought and imagination is positive philosophy does not, in my opinion, distinguish them from those who lick the honey without seeing the problem. I could not imitate these people, since I did not lack imagination and could not pretend that I did. Like every man who truly lives, I could not turn my eyes away from the mice and the dragon once I had seen them. The third means of escape is through strength and energy. It consists of destroying life once one has realized that life is evil and meaningless. Only unusually strong and logically consistent people act in this manner. Having realized all the stupidity of the joke that is being played on us, and seeing that the blessings of the dead are greater than those of the living, and that it is better not to exist, they act and put an end to this stupid joke. And they use any means of doing it: a rope around the neck, water, a knife in the heart, a train. There are more and more people of our class who are acting in this way. For the most part, the people who perform these acts are in the very prime of life, when the strength of the soul is at its peak and when the habits that undermine human reason have not yet taken over. I saw that this was the most worthy means of escape, and I wanted to take it. The fourth means of escape is that of weakness. It consists of continuing to drag out a life that is evil and meaningless, knowing beforehand that nothing can come of it. The people in this category know that death is better than life, but they do not have the strength to act rationally and quickly put an end to the delusion by killing themselves. Instead, they seem to be waiting for something to happen. This is the escape of weakness. For if I know what is better and have it within my reach, then why not surrender myself to it? I myself belonged in this category. Thus, the people of my class save themselves from a terrible contradiction in these four ways. No matter how much I strained my intellectual faculties, I could see no escape other than these four. Tolstoy's intellectual faculties, his rationality, could see no way out of the dilemma posed by his incorporation of an indigestible idea. Furthermore, logic clearly dictated that existence characterized only by inevitable and pointless suffering should be brought to an abrupt end as an evil joke. It was Tolstoy's clear apprehension of the endless conflict between the individual and the conditions of existence that destroyed his ability to work and undermined his desire to live. He was unable to see, at least at that point in his journey, that man was fashioned to confront chaos constantly, to eternally work toward transforming it into real being, rather than to master it finally, once and for all, and to therefore render everything intolerably static. The fact of mortal vulnerability, that defining characteristic of the individual and the reason for his emergent disgust with life, may be rendered even more unjust and intolerable by the specific manifestations of such vulnerability. Some are poorer than others, some weaker, some unsightlier, all less able in some regard, and some apparently less able in all regards. Recognition of the seemingly arbitrary distribution of skill and advantage adds additional rationally justifiable grounds for the development of a philosophy based on resentment and antipathy, sometimes on behalf of an entire class, other times sheerly for the purposes of a specific individual. Under such circumstances, the desire for revenge on life itself may become paramount above all else, particularly for the unfairly oppressed. Shakespeare's crippled Richard III speaks for all revolutionaries, all rebels so motivated. Then, since the heavens have shaped my body so, let hell make crooked my mind to answer it. I have no brother. I am like no brother. And this word, love, which graybeards call divine, be resident in men like one another and not in me. I am myself alone. Evil is voluntary rejection of the process that makes life tolerable, justified by observation of life's terrible difficulty. This rejection is presumptuous, premature, because it is based on acceptance of a provisional judgment as final. Everything is insufficient and is therefore without worth, and nothing whatsoever can be done to rectify the situation. Judgment of this sort precludes all hope of cure. Lack of belief in hope and meaning, which appear more than willing to vanish in the face of rational critique, seldom means commensurate lack of belief in anxiety and despair, even though recognition of the pointlessness of everything should also undermine one's faith in suffering. Suffering cannot be disbelieved away, however. Rejection of the process that constantly renews the positive aspect of the constituent elements of experience merely ensures that their negative counterparts gain the upper hand. Such additional torture, added to that already considered sufficient to bring about hatred for life, is sure to produce a character motivated to perform acts worse than mere suicide. The development of the adversary therefore follows a predictable path from pride, as Milton has it, pride and worse ambition threw me down, through envy to revenge, to the ultimate construction of a character possessed by infinite hatred and envy. To do aught good never will be our task, but ever to do ill our sole delight, as being contrary to his high will whom we resist. If then his providence out of our evil seeks to bring forth good, our labor must be to pervert that end, and out of good still to find means of evil. Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost. Tolstoy's nihilism, disgust with the individual and human society, combined with the desire for the eradication of existence, is one logical, evil consequence of heightened self-consciousness. It is not, however, the only consequence, and may not even be the most subtle. Far more efficient, far more hidden from the perpetrator himself and from his closest observers, is heightened identification with tradition and custom. This is envelopment in the guise of patriotism to facilitate the turning of state power toward destruction. Nietzsche described such loyalty in the following manner. Definition of morality. Morality, the idiosyncrasy of decadence, with the ulterior motive of revenging oneself against life, successfully. I attach value to this definition. This description of initial motivated decision and consequent dissolution seems to me to characterize the processes and bifurcated final state of moral and therefore psychological degeneration more accurately and potently than any purely scientific theory of psychopathology generated to date. Of course, we are at present unable to take our rationally reduced selves seriously enough to presume a relationship between evil as a cosmic force and our petty transgressions and self-betrayals. We believe that in reducing the scope and importance of our errors, we are properly humble. In truth, we are merely unwilling to bear the weight of our true responsibility. The adversary in action, voluntary degradation of the map of meaning. Who alone has reason to lie himself out of actuality? He who suffers from it. Friedrich Nietzsche. Tragic encounter with the forces of the unknown is inevitable in the course of normal development, given continued expansion of conscious awareness. Even socialized identification with the cultural canon cannot provide final protection. Unshielded personal contact with tragedy is inextricably linked with emergence of self-consciousness, which has as its mythic consequence, its virtual equivalent, heightened awareness of human limitation. This awareness is manifested in shame and has been expressed mythologically as shame of nakedness, which is knowledge of essential vulnerability and weakness before the world. The intrinsic nature of human experience ensures that potent motivation for deceitful adaptation is always present. It is the encounter with what is truly horrible and terrifying, after all, that inspires fear and engenders avoidance. The human tendency to flee into false havens of security can therefore be viewed with sympathy and understanding. Maturation is a frightening process. Transformation from the paradisal matriarchal world of childhood to the fallen masculine social world is fraught with peril. The same might be said about the dangers of post-apprenticeship individuality. It is not easy to become an adolescent after being a child. It might be said that this transition is in itself a heroic act. It therefore happens upon occasion that those who have abandoned heroism as a style of adaptation do not take even this first step. The relative advantages that accompany increased freedom may seem frightening and of dubious value, given the comparative responsibility and lack of security that are part and parcel of maturity. As maturation takes place, the environment transforms. As the developing individual masters his powers, his behavioral capacity expands. He can do more things and, in consequence, experience more things. The ability to bring heretofore unknown and therefore frightening phenomena into being constantly increases, and the boundaries of the experiential domain of the individual eventually extend beyond the area shielded by the parents. The capability to endlessly further apprehension is central to the adaptive capacity of the individual. This capability, however, comes at an immense price, which is knowledge of finitude and death. Potent motivation, therefore, exists to resist such development when it duly emerges, to fight desperately for maintenance of childhood ignorance or to hide in the commands of others. Individuality, which is the ability to establish a realm of experience that is unique to the self, the capacity for the creation of purely subjective experience, also means acceptance of vulnerability and mortality. The creative capacity is divine logos, which in the course of its development necessitates recognition of the inevitability of failure and death. That is, in part, the meaning of the symbol of the Christian crucifixion, which paradoxically melds mortality with divinity, which portrays the mortal God, infinitely creative, responsible, and vulnerable. Individual existence means limited existence, limited in space and time. The existence of the limits makes experience possible. The fact of them makes experience unbearable. We have been granted the capacity for constant transcendence as an antidote, but frequently reject that capacity because using it means voluntarily exposing ourselves to the unknown. We run away because we are afraid of the unknown at bottom. Such fear also makes us cling to our protective social identities, which shield us from what we do not understand. So, while running away, we necessarily become slave to convention and habit and deny the troublesome best within ourselves. Why run away? It is fear. Fear of the unknown and its twin, fear of rejection by the protective social world, which leads to pathological subjugation of unique individual personality, to rejection of the totality of personal being, which, when manifested, has truly redemptive capability. The Great Father hates innovation and will kill to prevent it. The Great Mother, source of all new knowledge, has a face that paralyzes when encountered. How can we not run away when confronted by such powers? But running away means that everything worthwhile ages, then dies.